From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
This week, my colleagues at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center and I were privileged to host our Carnegie colleague, Ashley Tellis. Ashley Tellis is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment based in Washington, D.C. He specializes in international security, defense, and Asian strategic issues. From 2001 to 2003, Ashley served as a senior advisor at the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi. And in 2003, he also served on the National Security Council staff as a special assistant to the president, Senior Director for Strategic Planning in Southwest Asia. While on assignment to the U.S. State Department as a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Ashley was intimately involved in negotiating the civil nuclear agreement with India. Ashley was in town for the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's fourth annual Carnegie Global Dialogue. This is a series of discussions we hold each year with scholars from across Carnegie's global network of centers to examine China's evolving foreign policy and international role. And this was the first time we did this in conjunction with the new Carnegie Center in New Delhi, India, and the center director there, Raja Mohan, who joined Ashley. In this podcast, I speak with Ashley after a week of dialogue we had with Chinese scholars, government officials, young leaders, students, business leaders, where we discussed President Trump's America First concept and what it might mean for U.S.-China relations. We also discussed our expectations for the first summit meeting between Presidents Xi and Trump, which will take place at Mar-a-Lago on April 6th and 7th. Please enjoy the conversation and leave us a rating on iTunes if you enjoy our podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us this morning, Ashley.
It's a pleasure, Paul. Pleasure.
I want to just start out, you've talked this week while you've been in Beijing in a number of different audiences, Chinese scholars, government officials, business community, diplomats. You've engaged a lot, and you've talked a lot about what you think, or to help people understand, President Trump's America First policy. You've said the concept suggests a much more nationalistic sentiment. He's articulated to a certain degree in the campaign, certainly, this national sentiment. And it resonated with a large swaths of Americans, enough to get him elected to be President of the United States. But we've really yet to hear from President Trump a systematic elaboration of what this means, what America First means. What, in your view, is meant by the America First approach? How is it new, and how is it not new for America?
That's a really good question, because one important thing to start off when you think about this issue is to recognize that Trump's views are not uniquely his views. Mm-hmm. The temptation is to dismiss them as quirky and idiosyncratic because of his personality. But I believe that his views represent a school of thought that has always existed in American political life. And let me explain that briefly by saying that since the country's founding, there have been essentially three schools in the United States. There's been an isolationist school, which has basically said that America does not need the world.
Right.
We are a self-contained nation, and we should stay that way. At the opposite end, there's an internationalist school, which believes that America's destiny is somehow linked to what happens in the wider world around it. And there is a nationalist school, which is actually best captured by the slogan, "Don't Tread on Me." It does not dismiss the world, but its point of entrance into politics is really what happens in America. It cares about America. So the world is important, but only in an instrumental fashion. It's not important for its own sake. Whereas the internationalists have always believed that it's important for its own sake, and liberal internationalists have believed that it has value because it represents the American ideal of the promotion of democracy, the rule of law, an ordered system of politics, and so on and so forth. Trump is genuinely nationalist. He sees the United States as first in every sense of the word, and is prepared to engage in the world, but only to the degree that it actually advances core American national interests.
So we have not had this kind of approach, it seems to me, over the last few decades. We seem to have been more internationally engaged. And so this aspect is relatively new for us, it seems.
Yes. And, in fact, throughout the Cold War,
yeah,
we went through the Cold War because there was a tacit alliance between the nationalists and the internationalists.
Hmm.
Both agreed that there was a genuine threat to the United States, and it was called the Soviet Union. The internationalists used that threat to create an entire architecture of order,
mm-hmm,
because that was, to them, the best device for dealing with Soviet power.
Mm-hmm.
The nationalists went along with them because their objective was to contain the Soviet Union, prevent the Soviet Union from attacking American interests. Mm. So there was a meeting of the minds, mm-hmm, as long as there was competition during the Cold War.
Mm.
But after the Cold War, when the major threats of the United States in the form of state power disappeared,
mm,
the cleavage between the nationalists and the internationalists began to open.
Mm-hmm.
Because nationalists began to look at the edifice that the internationalists had created as being burdensome,
yeah,
and using more American resources than was worth it.
Yeah.
Whereas for internationalists, the edifice had value in its own terms,
mm,
and therefore was worth paying the price to maintain.
Mm. Mm.
And Trump today, representing the upsurge of nationalism, is now beginning to say, hey, I understand the logic of having created this order. It served, mm, a certain purpose during the Cold War. But why should I be continuously paying,
right,
to maintain it?
Right. So the structures that have been created that we've been using, the architecture, the approach that agencies within the U.S. government have been taking since the end of the World War II and since the end of the Cold War, seem to have been consistently engaged in this international approach to the world. How will this change now? Will the structures have to change now to adapt to this new approach?
This is a very good question, and I don't think there is an easy answer to it. I think all the agencies of the U.S. government will have to reckon with the fact that they cannot go back to business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Because this president is going to be asking very hard questions about the utility,
mm-hmm,
of the international structures to the U.S. And so there will be two sets of bargaining processes that are taking place simultaneously.
Yeah.
One is the U.S. with the international system. How much of the international structures is the U.S. prepared to support and subsidize?
Right.
That's one set of discussions. And there is going to be an internal discussion within the American state system, within American society and the American state.
Mm.
And that is going to be how, you know, which of the inherited processes will have to change. And I think when Trump complains about, you know, the so-called deep state,
yeah,
it's really code for saying that all the objectives that you all pursued without questioning for 60 years are now open for questioning.
Mm-hmm.
And you better get used to that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are, of course, quirky elements to that complaint as well. But I think the broader issue is that Trump essentially signaling to the permanent government that it's not going to be business as usual. You're not going to get the latitude,
yeah,
to conduct your business from the old premises.
Yeah.
All these have to be revisited.
And is this in part why there's so much suspicion from Donald Trump and some of his key advisors in the White House towards these agencies? I mean, they haven't filled positions. They're not, it seems, the cabinet secretaries, many of them, are not necessarily relying on their agencies to support them. Is this, this must be part of this?
This is definitely part of it. There are two dimensions to this,
yeah,
challenge. One is the, what I would think of as the ideational dimension,
mm-hmm,
which is Trump seems to believe that the permanent government has not appreciated what the results of this election actually meant.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the permanent government is assuming that Trump is going to be an internationalist, plain and simple,
right,
like his predecessors.
Right. That he will conform. That
he will conform.
He will come around.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that his nationalism was simply a campaign strategy.
Yeah.
But it's not a strategy for governance.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I think there will be much more of Trump the nationalist in governance than people recognize. Mm. And so the permanent government is having some difficulty sort of understanding that.
Right.
Then the second is simply plain old politics. Mm-hmm. Because of the character of the campaign, many individuals who would have otherwise joined a nominally Republican administration have chosen not to join this administration or will not be invited into it by Trump and the people around him.
Yeah.
And so between the political constraints of having a much smaller pool to now choose from,
mm-hmm.
and the ideational constraint of having really two worldviews in collision.
Right.
And this, Paul, this leads to actually a larger question, which is what is the Republican Party? You know, what does its standard bearer stand for, and what does the party stand for?
Mm-hmm.
We always presumed that, particularly in the latter half of the Cold War, that the Republican Party was automatically internationalist.
Right.
But that was historically not true.
Right.
I mean, the early Cold War, it was the Republicans who were actually quite nationalist and had to be brought almost to the Republic, to the internationalist table.
Right. But certainly over the last several decades, the Republicans have been much more on the internationalist side of the equation. And the interesting thing is you see that several of his cabinet secretaries are internationalist, traditional, probably in their approach.
Yep.
I would imagine General Mattis, Secretary Mattis at DOD, Secretary Tillerson, been a CEO of a company that's been engaged in the world. But then in the White House, you have people who are maybe more nationalist. How would you describe that constellation? Because he's going to be influenced by people in the White House around him, family members, others.
Right.
But the cabinet secretaries will have a role too. How do you just see that constellation of advisors?
See, I see this as part of the internal negotiation that will constantly be taking place over the next 4 years. And sometimes the nationalists in the White House, people like Steve Bannon, Steve Miller, Peter Navarro, will have the upper hand.
Navarro, who's the head of the new National Trade Council.
Trade Council, will have the upper hand depending on the issues. On other matters, the internationalists will have the upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
I think crudely, and this is a very crude generalization, on matters that are more clearly international, foreign policy, defense strategy, I think the internationalists still have the edge because Trump has inherited a global order, which he simply cannot walk away from.
Well, I remember when Secretary of Defense Mattis came to Asia, he went to Korea and Japan, and the kind of things that he was saying and reassuring our allies of their importance to the United States sounded very much like what we've heard in the past. And I understand they didn't get a lot of guidance from the White House for those trips. So you see that's kind of the automatic feature that will kick in unless told otherwise.
Absolutely. And I think to the degree that these individuals have international responsibilities, I think their natural instinct will be to act upon the internationalist assumptions of the past.
Right.
And I think in many ways that is the smart thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But to the degree that there are issues relating to domestic politics, with respect to the management of the economy, with respect to the role of the United States in the international economic system,
mm-hmm.
I think in these areas, the nationalist sentiments of those who think differently from the legacy of the last 60 years, I think that's where in these issue areas, this group will have most influence.
And how do those advisors break down? You've mentioned Navarro leading the nationalist sentiment, Bannon, Miller. Who's on the other side, on the economic and trade? And
I think on the other side are people like Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
You will have individuals like Steve Mnuchin, who's Secretary of Treasury. They see the United States as being part of an international economic architecture, which is part of globalization, part of interdependence, part of a trading system.
Yeah.
And so while they recognize the need for correctives,
they
do not want to jettison the system altogether.
Right.
Whereas
use the same framework but get better bargains,
mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the nationalists, I think, are willing to consider more wholesale renovations than the traditionalists would contemplate.
Fascinating. And let's you're here in China. Let's turn to China now. And what you've described from President Trump seems to be best described as where his instincts are. Where can we expect there will be sort of consistent things that he will do, looking at U.S.-China relations, where would you expect to see the most dramatic changes on U.S.-China relations compared to what his predecessors did?
I think you will see a shift perceptibly in the economic relationship mm-hmm. with China.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think this is going to involve a wholesale jettisoning
mm-hmm.
of the U.S.-China trade relationship.
Yeah.
I think it is simply impossible, even for a president, mm-hmm. to do that no matter how much he wants. But I think Trump is going to be much more hard-nosed
mm-hmm.
in demanding that China change certain trade practices.
Right.
So the way it deals with its currency management,
right.
the way it deals with the requirement that Americans have local partners,
right.
the privileges that are afforded to SOEs in the global trading system,
right.
The very difficult relationship that China seems to have with international property regimes, and particularly American intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
I think on these issues, Trump is going to demand changes.
But let me just, if those sound to me like things that Hillary Clinton probably would have done, mm-hmm. or if another Republican president would have come on board. Somebody said to me the other day, is he going to do a 45% trade tariff on China? And I said, I don't think so. I think that was more campaign rhetoric. And somebody said, well, he's going forward with the Muslim ban. He's going forward with a number of things that he said he was going to do that no one ever thought he would do.
Right.
How do we know for sure that he's not going to do more? Some of those more Peter Navarro? Because if you look back at the things Donald Trump has said in the past, he has said as early as 1990, I'd love a trade war with China.
Yes.
So
I'm not ready to,
yeah.
first, I think it's, it's not productive to get into the prediction business with
right.
Trump,
sure.
right? Because
sure.
it's
right.
it's not a great market for success.
Right.
But I think the bottom line is this. Hillary Clinton and others had similar sentiments. The big difference is how central is it going to be to the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
For Trump, it is going to be a lot more central.
I see. Yeah.
For Clinton, this would be something she would also engage in and sort
mm-hmm.
of, work on, but in a much larger context,
yeah.
right? So there would be an effort made to balance whatever activity was done in these areas
mm-hmm.
with very conscious attempts at engagement in other
enhancing
areas.
Enhancing cooperation,
so on.
Things
absolutely.
Like that. Yeah.
Whereas for Trump, because this addresses not only his core intellectual interests,
right?
The whole nationalist agenda,
yeah.
but also his core electoral interests.
Yeah.
Because the people who voted for him deeply believe that their economic condition is a direct consequence of the U.S. inability to manage Chinese behaviors
right.
in these issue areas.
Right.
So he has to address the political interests that
right.
brought him to power.
Right.
And so that becomes far more central
mm-hmm.
To his agenda with China
mm-hmm.
than it might
mm-hmm.
have been
mm-hmm.
for another president.
Yeah. How about on the security side? How do you see, what changes do you expect with Donald Trump from what we've seen previously? There's real consistency between Bush and Obama in many ways.
Yes.
In fact, I stayed as China director from Bush administration into the Obama administration, and we used a very similar framework in the early days of the Obama administration. What do you see differently on the security side?
I don't see radical differences, even though people advertise,
yeah.
Trump's views about alliances and so on and so forth. I don't see radical differences for two reasons. One, the United States has enduring interests, irrespective of who's in office.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how nationalist Trump may be, he can't simply sort of walk away from the world order that he has inherited.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a simple reality. Two, the tasks that Bush recognized and that Obama recognized as important for national security are the same tasks that face Donald Trump.
Mm.
And so what I think he's going to do is actually do more of the same, more resolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So you are going to see increases in the defense budget.
Mm-hmm.
You are going to see more muscularity in American defense policy,
mm-hmm.
Investments in nuclear forces, continued activity in freedom of navigation, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there will be far greater continuity
mm-hmm.
on the defense and security side than people imagine.
So you've been here 3 days now. You're unfortunately getting ready to leave. You could stay longer if you'd be willing to. But,
oh, I'd love to.
We know you have to move on to bigger and better things. The lot of discussion about sort of the state of U.S.-China relations and this upcoming summit in Mar-a-Lago. And wanted to get a sense before you left where you see the state of U.S.-China relations currently, and what might we expect to see with this Mar-a-Lago, and why is it important?
You know, it's there is profound uncertainty
yeah.
in the bilateral relationship right now, because the Chinese, who have been beneficiaries of American internationalism, now have to confront the possibility that that world is at risk. So I think China has two clear objectives going into the summit in Mar-a-Lago. First is to arrive at a political modus vivendi with the United States that has a G2-like connotations, even if they declaim any interest in a G2-like arrangement, because they want the United States to treat them essentially as a peer. Because there are all sorts of political consequences that flow from that. So that's a very clear objective. Get Trump's consent to treat China as a peer, in exchange for which China would be willing to do many things to advance its domestic economic agenda.
Have they made an advancement on that objective already when Secretary Tillerson came here and used the language that Xi Jinping has used to describe the new type of great power relationship?
I think they have made a great advance towards that objective. I think from my vantage point, it was an unfortunate advance because it...
Unfortunate for U.S. interests.
For U.S. interests, because it represents a break with U.S. policy. It threatens the alliance system that we have built in the last 60 years. And it actually creates the preconditions for a Chinese domination in Asia, which is neither in American interests nor in the region's interests. But there is a second objective that the Chinese have as well, and that is to entice Trump to do whatever he can to protect globalization, at least to the degree that it allows China continued access, unimpeded access to external markets. And so I don't think the Chinese are apostles of globalization in an abstract sense.
They need it.
But they need continued uninterrupted access to global markets. And to the degree that the nationalism of Trump begins to have emulative effects elsewhere, that is catastrophic for China's strategy, including for Obor. And so there's the second prong of Chinese interests that I think will
be seen. And they're worried about that.
And they're worried about that, and rightly so.
Yeah.
And rightly so.
Ashley, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. We look forward to you coming back, and we look forward to you joining the China in the World podcast again. Thank you very much.
I'd love that. Thank you so much, Paul.
That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.